out from the cube. We are doing something a little different this week as we get going with this week's episode. We are actually doing a number of episodes with guests that are from DevUp, the DevUp conference that is being hosted in St. Charles, Missouri, right outside of St. Louis, actually a mile or two from where I live. And we're very fortunate this week that we were able to get Richard Campbell on as a guest. If you don't know Richard Campbell, he essentially runs one of the largest technical podcasts in the nation. As we get going, you'll listen to some things that he says about how he got that podcast going, how he got involved, and the number of episodes they're on. I believe they're somewhere around 1,500 episodes, which puts us to shame figuring we just recorded episode 42. So we're very lucky to have Richard Campbell on. We want to make sure to thank him for that. But there's going to be a number of other episodes that we release over the next couple days with people from the DevUp conference. So thank you for listening. Look for some of these. Some of these that are from the DevUp conference will be more technical in nature, but definitely in sync with the message, mission, and vision of the podcast that we've had up to this point. But before we get going with Richard Campbell, I want to make sure that we do thank our sponsor. Our sponsor, again, is Polaris Solutions. And from idea to implementation, Polaris Solutions combines business and technical expertise with a lean startup approach to build custom software that enables employees to work smarter, move faster, and achieve more. And you can learn more about Polaris Solutions by going to their website at polarissolutions.com. So I hope you enjoy this week's guest. Again, it's Richard Campbell. We're very fortunate to have him. He gave a great keynote yesterday, which was Tuesday, with the DevUp conference. We're very fortunate that he spent an hour and 15 minutes with us, where we talked about how he got his podcast going and the direction of technology and what he is afraid of moving forward technology. He's also involved in some exciting charities that involve technology and giving and helping disaster relief. And we're very lucky that he was able to share with us how he got that going and kind of the outcomes that he has with that. So enjoy the episode. Again, if you would please share the episode with people that you may find some value out of it. Subscribe to the episode, share it, and reach out to us if there's anything we can do to help you. So again, enjoy the episode and look for other episodes this week from the DevUp conference. Welcome to another episode of Out from the Cube. We're now at episode 42. So we've cranked these out since April. And if you listen to the podcast that we put out Monday of this week, episode 41, we talked about that this week would be a little different. Usually on Mondays, we do a weekly roundup where I kind of go through some notes of books I'm reading, people I'm talking to, and other podcasts that I listen to. And I kind of throw out some of the content that I've learned and that resonated with me. But this week we had Edie Vardell on, who I'd go back and listen to that. I took two pages of notes on that conversation, and it's one of a few podcasts that I have recorded that I have actually gone back and listened to again just to get more notes on things that she was talking about. That and with Edie, I have very similar passions with her. So, and now later in the week, whenever you listen to this, we'll release this, I believe, on the Wednesday of this week. We are fortunate. There's a technical conference in St. Louis that is going on right now, actually a mile or two from my house. And it's called DevUp. It used to be called Days of .NET, and it's gone on for maybe 10 plus years. And we are fortunate that through some connections, we were able to get Rich Campbell on, my fault.
The other guy
on. And as we started this, I said, don't say that. So Rich Campbell is on. Rich Campbell, it was the keynote at DevUp this week and just got done an hour or so delivering his keynote and did a fantastic job. And it's one of those talks, though, when I'm sitting in the back of the room that I am reminded that I am a basketball coach. it was a great talk, and things that that were over my head with how I was raised and what I do and my education level. But I was sitting back going, yeah, I'm without question a basketball coach. But really enjoyed the cup. But we're fortunate. We have Angela Dugans here with us as well. Angela and I work together at Polaris Solutions. And through the connection with Angela, we were able to get Rich Campbell on. So with that, welcome. And let me also say this. We're fortunate to have him, but you are responsible for how many podcasts at this point, as of this date?
Pretty close to 2,100 episodes of different shows. So we've done, coming up on the 1,600th episode of .NET Rocks, although I'm the new guy. I came on board as a co-host in show 100.
In 2007, I launched a show called Run As Radio, which just passed its 600th episode. And for a brief interval between 2011 and 2014, we made another show called The Tablet Show, where we were trying to figure out, well, I mean, the truth is, we weren't sure if .NET rocked anymore after Build 2011, when that was the Windows 8 and the WinJS and all of this weird stuff. And so we built a contingency show. But we, after 140 episodes of Tablet Show, we realized .NET did rock and that these shows made sense as part of .NET Rocks, and we rolled it back in. So 1,500 .NET Rocks episodes, 600 Run As is on 140 Tablet Shows. Right. 2,200 shows.
Yeah, so you said on the way up here to where we're recording that you started in what year? You said April of?
Run As Radio started April 11th, 2007, every Wednesday since then. So yeah, I'm persistent. Carl started .NET Rocks back in 2002, which is before the word podcast even exists, right? We didn't start calling it podcast until 2005. So I was a guest on his show in 2004, and we just sort of clicked and and stayed close. And I came on as co-host February of 2005.
So five, and your .NET Rocks podcast, two episodes a week?
Two a week these days, yeah.
Two a week. So if I'm on episode 42 and you're around 1,500, and that's, so I've got a ways to go to.
You know, I think getting to 50 is a big deal.
Yes.
A lot of podcasts die before their first 50.
Yes.
And at 100, throw a party. Like, that's a really big deal. There are relatively few shows to get past 100 episodes.
And again, I have a tendency to bounce a fair amount with the podcast. Mm-hmm. The metrics on that, like, how many people per episode? I know Tim Ferriss is a guy I listen to. He's a podcast guy that does kind of lifestyle entrepreneur stuff. He talks about a 6-week window, post-production window, to get a certain amount of views. And I'm not sure why it's 6 weeks for that metrics. But what do you typically get on an episode?
We normally get about 50,000 downloads in the first 24 hours of a show being published. And then we get another 50 to 100 over the next 4 to 6 weeks.
Wow. So within the first 24 hours, 50,000.
Yeah.
Okay. So that gives us, we've got a ways to go with that. So
remember, we have first mover status. I don't know how I would make a podcast with those kinds of numbers starting today. Because we never have really marketed .NET Rocks. We were first. That's our advantage. We're one of the oldest podcasts on the planet. You know, there's a couple of NPRs around today that are from that same, around the 2002 era, but virtually any other podcast you can find from that time is gone. So, you know, I'm not going to presume we have any secrets of any kind. We are persistent. We like to produce quality. I care a lot about what software developers care about, you know, in the immediate future, the next 3 to 6 months from now. Like that, you think about what I do all day, it's figuring out what devs need to know next and help tell those stories.
Has that been what has sustained it? Is it so there's clearly a service to this. Like you're getting information from Microsoft or from another of different places or clients or experiences that you're currently having. And there's a service to that, right? Like, hey, I can now distribute to apparently 50,000 people over the next 24 hours. I'm going to be able to give content to, educate, and help their careers, right? Is that what continues to drive you? I mean, that's a long time to be running two or three different podcasts.
Well, and they pay, right? Like, I sell advertising on the show, so it pays for the costs and it makes me some money. But this is me being my best self. Like, I actually really enjoy storytelling in the technology space. And so part of being a good storyteller is you've got to gather the stories and how you share them out. And ultimately, these shows are not about me. They're about my guests. My work is figuring out what the right guest and the right topic is at the time. And sometimes I'm better at it than other times, too. Right. I mean, you can see it in the show download numbers. When you hit a hot button issue, you know, numbers can double and triple. And you can be part of a controversy, too, or part of exploring a problem. Years ago, we did a show that we ended up calling "Is Software Development Getting Too Complex?" And it was a panel show in the first place, but it was one of those shows that got so much traction, like it handed around so many places that the download numbers were through the roof, because it's just like we hit a point in the gestalt where everybody was struggling with this issue and they thought it was them, and we lent voice to that at that particular time. Maybe it's not us. Maybe they are making this harder than necessary. And that was a time when Microsoft had really fragmented the stack. You know, for a long time, everything that Microsoft made shipped every 18 months. Studio came out with all the stuff in it. Mm-hmm. But that wasn't fast enough. Microsoft was trying to learn to go faster, and so they started shipping out a band, so different pieces would be deployed at different times. And that fragmentation of the stack became very hard on developers. Mm-hmm. And that led to that particular conversation.
Hmm. So when you came on with Carl at the start of .NEXT Raw, what were you doing at that time? Like, he brought you on for a reason with your...
Yeah, we met at a software developers conference. So my skill set was primarily in performance tuning, which that really came to be through the .com boom, the late 90s, early aughts. That's where the money was. You know, I'm an old school dev. I wrote my first line of code in 1977, and I have good skills in the hardware and the networking. I'm not afraid of databases, and so... As the .com boom came to be, I became this firefighter. I was the guy you called in when your website just wasn't fast enough, because I'm not going to automatically go to the code. I do look at the network configurations. I do look at database problems and so forth, and you find the bottleneck in that particular system, and you help it go faster. And that led to great conference talks. People like to talk about these kinds of things, and I can go into details on all these different aspects of what makes a high-performance site, and you know, part of that is also the team. So I was on the speaking circuit in the late 90s and early aughts. Carl and I met at a conference in Montreal in 2004. It was the Dev Teach, I think. And we were at a speaker's dinner, pretty normal thing, you know. And mm-hmm. you know what speaker's dinners are like. There's bunches of tables around. And I was telling stories, as I am prone to do. I am a storyteller. And Carl talks about it as literally heard me from the other side of the room and just came over to listen to the stories. And one of the stories, he goes, I need that on my show.
Right.
I'm like, okay. So we went and did that. That was the episode I did with him first. And then...
And how long did it take after that before he said, hey, you know what, you need to be on? Like,
we really started... at the time that I got involved with .NET Rocks, he was still experimenting with format. This is before the word podcast even exists, right? Mm-hmm. So... At that particular time, his co-host was a guy named Rory Blythe, and the show was almost 2.5 hours. It was a variety show. So Carl's a quite accomplished musician, so he would play some music, and they would tell some jokes, you know, some geeky stories and things like that, and in the midst of it, there'd be an interview. Mm-hmm. And so after I'd done my show, and I was, you know, I'm a technology guy and into gadgets and things like that, we had some fun with different gadgets where it's like, let me show you this thing that's really cool. Now let me show you this thing's really horrifying. Mm-hmm. And so I said, why don't you do that as a bit on .NET Rocks? And so after my show, within a week or two, a couple of weeks, and at that time he was publishing once a week, I would listen to the recording. So he put me into the loop and I'd listen to while making the show. And I'd learn something about the guest over the course of the conversation. And then I'd find a gadget I thought the guest would really, really like, and one that would absolutely horrify them. Hmm. And so that was sort of a closing bit on .NET Rocks for a while. Hmm. But as Rory went to work for Microsoft and just got so busy, he couldn't do the co-hosting. So Carl started wrestling around for a new co-host. And I didn't think we were that good of a fit at that time, just because in a lot of ways we were too similar. But I'm much more of an enterprise guy. You know, doing performance tuning, things like that, where he is much more of an in-the-weeds, fingernails, dirty kind of programmer. And so that ultimately we emphasized those aspects of ourselves to give a different view on a given problem. Mm-hmm. When you're trying to represent the audience, right? You know, when you're talking to a guest. And so, you know, he can do that in-the-weeds conversation, I can do that. So what does this mean for me going forward, like one of those broad-reach conversations? And so, yeah... The other thing that happened even before I came on board at Show 100 is that we started reorganizing the show, recognizing that it was too long. I just said, there's a Venn diagram here. There's people who really like the funny stuff, and there's people who really like the technical interview, but the intersection between those two is small, mm-hmm. and we're hurting the audience. And so we actually ended up making a comedy show that stood on its own called Mondays, and we dialed the interview show back to an hour and almost entirely the interview. There's a couple of radio bits in there. We do a little intro stuff. We have to, you know, do a plug for the sponsor, that kind of thing. For the most part, it's in, you know, of that hour, 45 to 50 minutes of it is the guest talking.
Where does Carl live?
He's in New London, Connecticut.
So you guys are on. And you're in Vancouver,
yeah,
right?
So opposite coast.
So opposite coast. And you just – so what happened? Like what point did you have to make a decision? on what you're doing professionally up to that point and the effort and energy and preparation that it takes to put on a podcast at that level?
It happened incrementally. So for me coming on at 100, I was the third co-host. So the first co-host did 50 shows. Rory did 50 shows. And at that point, it was Mark Dunn who was the first co-host. So he was, in a lot of ways, he's the guy, you know, the rarest thing is leaders are fairly easy to find, right? Mm-hmm. First followers, they're hard to find. And so Mr. Dunn, who's a Southern gentleman out of Alpharetta, Georgia, great trainer and consultant in his own right, he's the one who really supported Carl way at the beginning when this is just like the only people who can listen to this is your grandmother, right?
Right.
And they weren't weekly or anything. It was all an experiment. It took time to sort of develop a model. So Mark did the first 50 shows over about a year and a half with Carl. And he's like, okay, I think we've proven this. It kind of works. You know, you're coming up on your 50. Mm-hmm. You know what the feel is like. And so Mark moved on. And that's when Rory came on board. And then by 50 shows in, Rory just because wasn't able to do it anymore. So I was looking at this. I'm going to do 50 shows. And we're weekly cadence on the button, so it's like I got a year. I'll do a year. It's like, and at that time, you know, Carl's running the whole thing. I know nothing, right? I'm just a voice in the wilderness. So it's every Friday we get together and we'd record this thing. So it was just a thing I did, you know, for fun. Now things started to change. First off, I'm a planner. I'm a very organized guy, and
good.
Carl,
we can have an episode about that.
Yeah,
we could geek out on that then.
For sure. And so, it was agonizing to me that over the course of the week, I don't know what the show is coming up. I can't prep. Literally, most of the time, Carl will get the guest Friday morning. We're going to record this afternoon, and it's like, dude, I can't live like this. Hmm. So I started doing more of the content planning, and I care a lot about story arcs. And so pretty quickly, it's not just any old show. It's like we have four or five principal story arcs that we're pursuing things around. You know, today it's stuff like the cloud, you know, and cloud migration. It's DevOps,
right?
You know, it's developmental skills and, polyglot programming, working in different programming languages. So I make sure that I'm visiting those topics on a routine basis. And you can actually go back and pluck those shows and say, hey, I'm telling a story here, getting further and further down the path. So I think that way. I enjoy that. And as we were getting more sponsorship and so forth, we could dial up the number of shows. You could actually got more flexibility to tell that. For a long time, we made three shows a week. And so the Tuesday show tended to be the very technical show, like down in the weeds, writing the code, that's the sort of thing. The Wednesday show would be a little more of the broader reach. Are you building the right things? What are your overall strategies, project management, that kind of thing? And then the Thursday show would be the anything goes. Maybe a little history, maybe, you know, just broader career-oriented topics. And that's where the geek outs ultimately landed, was on the Thursday shows. We're down at two shows a week, which is still plenty. But and so they were a little more flexible in the models. But that thinking that way is really what got me going. The other thing that happened in my first 50 is we went on a road trip. So we got sponsorship from Microsoft and other companies, and we rented an RV, and we stuck logos on it like a NASCAR, and we drove from New London down the Eastern Seaboard and across to California. So we did 15 stops in 3 weeks. So five shows a week, more or less. Might have been a little bit more. And that's in 2005. And so, A, I hit my 50 mark on the road, so it's kind of can't go home now. And I was enjoying myself. You know, we were having a good time together. And, you know, we were good on stage together, right? Feed off each other well, and people enjoyed that. So there was a thing there.
Right.
And so it scratched an itch for me. It scratched a niche that the market needed. Carl really enjoyed it. He didn't mind handing over the content reins to me. And so we pretty quickly split into this. I think about what's next, what shows we need to make, and I schedule all of that. We intersect at the recording point, and then all the post-production work is his. How the editing that gets done, although we have a staff of editors because we make so many shows, and how it gets published, the engines behind all of that, how the ads get inserted, that's all Carl's problem. So he's the back end, I'm the front end in terms of how the stories are told.
Right. So, and we talked before we started about kind of what we talk about, you know, my background in coaching and basketball and athletics, and now kind of coupled with technology. But now what you have me thinking about is how well your podcast works. And I'm not thinking about content. I'm thinking about how well you and Carl work as a team,
mm-hmm.
and how roles get developed.
Yep.
And the thing I see with teams, and the thing that I'm fascinated by, and when I observe people in leadership positions or teams, is the level of ego. So what I heard you say 30 seconds ago was Carl had no problem giving you control of the content.
Right.
And this is his show.
He started it.
You know what I mean?
Like, yeah,
this
he owns
is his
it.
Show
totally.
And he's calling people on Friday morning and getting them on at Friday at 2 o'clock, and you guys are recording, and that's the way it's gone up to this point, 100 plus episodes.
Yep.
Now somebody else is coming along. Sure, I connect with him, but it's my show.
Yeah.
It's my product. But I'm going to let you run with that. So,
I basically demanded it. Like, be very clear. It's like, listen, I cannot live like this.
Right.
I need to know more in advance. If we're going to start doing conferences and things, I want shows in the can so we don't have to record on the road if we don't want to.
Right.
Right. Like, that was the – and I just – we were really having a conversation about how you turn podcasting into a business. And I built a lot of businesses over the years. And so I was thinking radio, like those models. How are we going to instrument this? How do we understand our customer feedback? Like, how do we get all of those things? You know, how do you get from just paying the bills or, you know, doing it as a hobby into something that's profitable and growable, right. and you know where to press on it to do more, right? This working on the business versus working in the business.
Right.
And so part of that was, so I'm thinking about the work on parts. How do we grow? Where do we get more listeners? So like reorganizing the show into technical conversation show and separate shows around music and comedy and things like that. That was a work on the business decision. It's like, I think, I have a hypothesis that we'll have more listeners if we're more focused. Okay, so this is what the model looked like. Let's make some shows. Let's measure the results. Are we getting more listeners? Okay, this worked. Right, a total work on the business, where the content planning part is a work in the business problem. Right, it's like, all right, one of the problems we have here is we don't know what we're doing far enough in advance. We have to start planning what shows need to be next. That is a physical activity I have to do, sort of come up with the content plans, reach out to the right people, get them scheduled, get them record, so that we can get to the recording point.
Right, was that a tough convert when that popped into your head, like we need to do this, or I need this in order to be my best self and provide the most value to this. Was that to sit him down and ask that question? Like,
no, I think it wasn't that difficult. You know, he was looking to do better too. So we were pretty respectful of each other. It's like, don't argue the skills one way or the other, but I come with a different set of experiences and nothing permanent. It's like, let me do the scheduling for the next month. All right. And then boop, boop, boop. We know what the shows are for the rest of the month. And he's like, wow, that didn't suck. Like, right. No, it really didn't. It's not like I'm not going to take suggestions from him either.
Right.
Right. But I'm good at all of those things that he did that were necessary as opposed to what he enjoyed.
Right.
So, you know, we were valuing the differences in our skill sets there too. So it didn't take very long before he's like, just do it. You're
right.
Good.
Right. So with the companies that you work with or maybe that you consult with or companies that you have seen, now you got me on this role definition. In my mind, you know, and we do talk about teams and role definition is really important and figuring out who has what skills and who's excellent at what or who needs to be in front or behind or like and how we collaborate and how we communicate and kind of tear down those walls is, you know, role definition is really important in an organization.
But I think a lot of the challenge there is often emerging, right? Like you have to find it. You trying to figure it all out in advance has got its own set of problems, too. Right. We're looking at personalities. We're valuing the differences. There's no question that Carl could do content planning,
right.
But he didn't enjoy it near as much. And so he did it at a necessity level as opposed to how do you tweak and tune? You know, I look at personality. I have a partner in the conference business who loves to go over banquet documentation line by line and find errors in it, right? Mm-hmm. And it's not a trivial thing. She pulls back 20% of our food costs. Like, it's a lot of money. I would blow my brains out doing that, right? It's not that I couldn't read that through that thing. I would just hate every moment of it.
Right.
So the fact that here's someone who's delighted with that, that that's what they enjoy, it's incredible value proposition there. So it's like recognizing that's a skill and it's valuable and sort of seeing where people fall in those things. That, and then the challenge is having that meta conversation, the on versus in. We spend so much time on the in and very little time on the on.
Right.
Right.
I think that's smart.
And so it's like, when do we have our on conversations?
Yeah, so it's interesting, something that you've been talking about, and I realize I'm kind of going a little bit left with where the topic is going, is I feel like it's been similar, too, with how we look at keynoters at conferences in general, right? So I think about the number of conferences I've been to in my technical career, right? Early on, most keynotes were very technical,
sure.
Right? Pulling up code, the dreaded writing code in a keynote, hoping nothing bombs, right?
Yep.
And I remember, I don't know, maybe 4 or 5 years ago, right? There's another conference I'm involved in where I remember that year we made a very specific decision to bring in keynoters that were not going to talk technology.
Sure.
Right? They took things in a much different direction, responsibility, persona, supporting each other. And it made me think about your keynote today,
mm-hmm.
right? It was inspirational. It was very thought-provoking. Did you feel that shift as someone who does a lot of conference speaking? And how do you choose the topics you talk about? So today was, I felt so different than what people, even at DevUp, are used to hearing based on past keynoters. Like, what kind of inspired you to go the direction you did today?
I do feel like we're at an interesting inflection point as software developers. You know, in some ways, our technology is kind of settled. Right, we have been doing keyboard, mouse, screen development for quite a while. Mobile has stabilized. It's touch. It's, you know, varying form factors. You've got to be a little more restrictive in that respect. When you look at the emerging aspects of software development, it's much more in the areas of deep learning, neural networks, and so forth. And now we're suddenly confronted with issues around data bias. And I think, in general, a more ethical conversation about software as a whole. Like, I feel like we've sort of picked the low-hanging fruit of performance improvements in software, and now it's in the ways that we optimize businesses. Now we're looking much more deeply into the way we change business practices around these automations. And we are eliminating classes of work. And I think you're generally seeing an anxiety in our society about what work looks like in the next decade or so. And developers aren't immune to that. We've always reduced the amount of labor that certain tasks inside of businesses involve. But now those reductions are looking more and more like entire categories of work going away. And so you check your heart, right? This is where your personal morality needs to be validated. Do you know what you do, why you do it, and what it means to you? You can't ignore that in the inflection points that are coming right now. It's a good time for us to do those gut checks. And so for me, building these kinds of keynotes has been, and coincidentally, this particular show had a future look aspect. So we got to anchor on 2025, and I got to look forward on a bunch of those aspects and say, here's where we've had to make these decisions. But it's something that's happening right now. So pretty consistently, as you see these sort of visceral responses from people around the things we're able to do with technology, we drop into that uncanny valley. And it's uncanny valley is normally a reference to robotics, right? But as long as robots are industrial or cute, we don't mind them. But as we try to make them look more and more human, you suddenly dip into this category where it's human but not human enough. And you get a revulsion response. That's the uncanny valley. More and more different aspects of technology in the past few years are banging against uncanny valley or revulsion responses. And it's surprising people. They're shocked. And so I think it's a good time for us, knowing we're having these responses, to sort of say, like, what are we afraid of? What are we concerned about? And are we centered on doing the right thing, whatever that actually looks like? And so, you don't get to make decisions for people in a scenario. All I'm really doing is looking you in the eye and saying, are you thinking about this? Because if you're not, it's going to surprise you.
Well, and I think it's interesting, too, because so George's podcast is called Out from the Cube. And while this may not be exactly the way he was thinking about From the Cube, I feel like that's kind of what you're asking people to do, is we've gotten so used to kind of getting into the cube, getting our heads down, right, seeing the requirements, building the thing, going, here's the thing. but not asking if the thing is the right thing,
yes.
right? If it's the best thing we could do with our time. How are we making the world better with what we're doing? And it's interesting because, as I was listening to the keynote, probably everyone took a slightly different message from it. And one of the messages I took is how can I find ways to use my power as someone who can wield software, right? And not use it as a weapon, but use it to make the world a better place.
Sure.
Right.
And I press on that fairly hard at the end, that we have that choice, right? We've always had that choice, actually. It's just becoming much more present, that folks are very aware of. You do have a choice of what you do with this particular set of skills. The big thing that's happened is the digitization of society as a whole has just meant that our reach is so great. It used to be these were only machines in one room in the house or in one part of the office. And now everybody has a supercomputer in their pocket. It's just normal, right? We have the smartphone movement has digitized society. And one of the byproducts, the combination of the smartphone and social media is what's largely brought back artificial intelligence with deep learning. That's the source of all the data. That we've now been able to do so many things that have tripped the uncanny valley effects. Like, why does Facebook know this about me? You know, why are we able to have perfectly targeted messages that happen to be lies aimed at us so that they tweak those visceral responses in our brain in a direction we probably didn't actually want to go? So, and it's a side effect of these combinations of technology. So this, I think it's why you see that overall anxiety. We have made something that is a little frightening to us. It's not the first time. You know, the difference is that it's pretty odd that it's socially wide. But if you go back and read the newspapers from the early part of the 20th century when the car first came out, there were people decrying the end of civilization because of the car. Right, and that it was going to need to be regulated, which it was. Right, and these things continue to happen. I recently read a group of papers around the church saying that Gutenberg's press was the end of civilization, because the church had controlled the production of right. all writing, and suddenly an unlearned man with a machine can make duplicates of written word? That's crazy. So we've consistently, as a civilization, developed technologies that have frightened us. And we happen to be in that period right now. And so for us as the builders, as the makers of the presses, make sure you're building the thing you want to build. Make sure you can look yourself and anyone else in the eye and say, I did the best I could. And I with the best of intent.
Yeah, and it's funny because it, the message you gave this morning also made me think about something that I don't know that everyone is necessarily aware of. So one of the things I learned about probably, 5 or 6 years ago, probably the first time I think I heard you speak in a keynote was something that you started called Humanitarian Toolbox, mm-hmm. which I'd love to be able to maybe give a little bit more education to people around that.
Because sure.
sometimes I think we assume that everybody knows the things that we do.
Yeah.
But there probably are some folks out there maybe listening to this podcast who aren't aware of that. And I think that kind of is a kind of a good segue to the whole, like, are we doing things that can actually make positive impacts on the world?
I've been involved with charitable efforts for many, many years in different forms. I mean, I've gone to Nepal and helped build a library for a school and those kinds of things, just experimenting with how do I feel like I'm making a contribution to society that matters to me. And I was abundantly aware that it was really hard for software developers to give their skills to a good cause, because we all know that software is not free. Right, you make something for somebody, they have to live with it. Software is free the same way that a puppy is free. Right, it needs care and maintenance. It sometimes makes a mess on the floor. Like, there's things you need to do. You don't get to stop working on it, actually. And I think most responsible software developers know enough of that that you're either so committed to a cause that it literally becomes a routine part of your life, essentially indefinitely, or you don't do it. And I've seen various models of trying to give software skills to different charitable efforts that struggle with that exact problem. Maybe it's only a weekend that we put things in, but the charity has to live with what you make at the end of that weekend. So HT Box was about a understanding that there's a responsibility part of software that we can probably take off the table so that the volunteer developers know that's taken care of and they can just write code, which is what they enjoy doing, what their valuable skill is. And so that project management part that we're responsible for in the charity represents a relatively small spend, right? We raise money to employ project managers because we try to do with volunteer project managers, it just didn't work. Like, you need focused attention. And their main thing is gather the right requirements, write them as, up as issues inside of GitHub that become work items that a volunteer developer on a weekend, or some do it as part of their routine of week. You know, we used to go bowling on Wednesdays. Now we write code and make those contributions, and we can build products over time that way. And they're very reliable. I'm very pleased with the quality of the software we make. Because everybody's a volunteer, nobody gets to keep things in their head. There's just no way to do that. So our documentation strategies are pretty strong. Our testing strategies are pretty strong. Because you have to deal with this variability of developers.
So when did you start doing that? And how, that was, I guess, how did you, I mean, there was a mindset shift at some point. You're like, hey, we can do more, I can do more, and here's a need. Like, what was the connection to start that, and who did you involve? Is that something? Because go ahead before I kind of go.
So the initial inspiration came out of another road trip we were doing at .NET Rocks, where the sponsor, in this case it was Microsoft, was saying, like, we'd like a charitable angle on this. And one would argue that if I'd just done like a mattress dollar for dollar United Way, we could have taken care of this. But I went on this rant about how frustrated I was with the problems of software developers making contributions. And that sort of led to this idea of, can we build some infrastructure that would allow that to work better? And it seemed like a good enough idea that somebody had already done it. So then my next reaction to I have a good idea is, let's see who else has done it. And I did find a few other organizations, but they all struggled with the thing I didn't think I would have a problem with, which was getting volunteer developers. I've got this audience of developers that I know want this thing. So the ability to actually sort of raise and understand how someone would feel good about a contribution, right? Like, software developers are not cogs in a machine. You can't just, fit here, go there. It's what inspires someone to take a Saturday off and learn about a project well enough to make a contribution to it. And so I thought I understood that fairly well, and it was a learning exercise. I also, right off the bat, and I have my notes in OneNote from the original meeting on this, so I know exactly the things I was going through. First off was, let's not make it US-centric. I'm a Canadian, so I'm already biased that way, but it's like, look, there's software developers everywhere. So whatever we're going to do, it should be equal opportunity. And that's where we ended up on disaster response. You know, natural disaster strike everywhere. Disaster relief is important everywhere. Mm-hmm. This is the one of these things that just, it is not specific to a culture. It'll work anywhere. I've later found there's complications to that, because there are variations in cultures and how they address these particular problems. But that was my thinking at the time. And certainly open source helped us. It was a great place to put the software, and it immediately took away this whole protectiveness of it. Like, look, I don't get to pick who wins here, who gets to use it. It's on GitHub. Take a copy. Knock yourself out, right? Anybody can use it. And so I didn't want to have to make those decisions. I didn't want to need to pick those winners, and those problems just went away. Now, it took us time to learn how to do the project management properly, how to prepare the work items in a way that would actually encourage volunteers, developers to pick them up and run with them and be successful, be productive with them, you know, feel that they made a valuable contribution. And we wrote all that stuff down now. You know, it's just like, there's a process on how you build software that works that way. And then the challenge was going in and recruiting into the disaster response organizations to say, hey, we could help you. Mm-hmm. And they're a skeptical bunch. You know, they get a lot of volunteers and a lot of mediocre results. And so to jump through the high bar of disaster response organizations is really an interesting exercise. Like, that has been fun and challenging. But it was in 2012 that all of this started. And I think we really got our feet under us by about 2013. I didn't start out wanting to be a registered charity. I thought it'd make more sense to work with one of the other organizations. But after a certain amount of time, you sort of hit this point of, no, we kind of need to be our own entity. It's mostly involving lawyers. Mm-hmm. And so you get the legal constructs in place, and the IRS has to approve. And so we are a U.S. registered charity, although we can take foreign contributions. There's certain rules around all of that. And certainly on our radar is when to register with other countries as their charitable organizations, recognizing that each one of those registrations represents several thousand dollars annually in accounting requirements. But in exchange, which basically tells that government then certifies you so that the folks that are making donations related to that country can get their tax deduction, which that's what it really comes down to.
What kind of products are we talking with that people would build?
So these mostly focus on what can cloud and mobile do to make a disaster response worker more efficient? So it's a lot of organizing teams and a lot of identifying and tracking information. So the Already project, which is usually our largest one, is really about managing volunteers efficiently via their phones. So you're creating event opportunities. One of our initial working case for Already came from the Red Cross. And not a disaster response so much as a disaster prevention, specifically around house fires. So it was getting smoke detectors installed in the homes that don't have them. Something that the Red Cross to this day continues to do. They run drives all the time. Smoke detectors are cheap. There's lots of people who have them, but often they're broken. And so the only tricky part of a smoke detector is knowing where to install it in a house where it's likely to actually do its job and save a life in the case of a fire. And so there are qualified installers. It's not rocket science or anything, but often it's volunteer firefighters, it's construction people, and so forth. And they only have so much time, and they actually want to install smoke detectors. So the Red Cross would do a drive, right? They're set up in a Home Depot or something saying, do you have a working smoke detector, right? Or in church parking lots, and they would get names and addresses of folks who would like to have a smoke detector installed. Once they've got enough of those together, and that can take weeks, then they sort of hand the list to different volunteers with a stack of smoke detectors. Okay, go and install them. And their success rate was relatively low. Enough time has gone by that people forget, and they may or may not be home. And so it's frustrating for a volunteer to go out with 8 smoke detectors and come back with 6 of them because nobody was at home and so on. So adding cloud and mobile to that equation shortened up the time loop, meant that people didn't have to travel as much. You got the list directly onto your phone so you could sort of go from home. We were better able to use GIS to organize it so there's all people nearby where you are. And then you throw in clever tricks like we worked with Twilio, so you can actually push a button and say, I'm about to go to this person. They'll call in advance. And so Lauren, you're the person's phone. So now the guy, we hand him 8 smoke detectors, he comes back with 2.
Right.
And I said, okay, well, we're getting yield. But you can take that basic mechanism of organizing needs regionally and skilled people that can fulfill those needs into a lot of different solutions. We've worked with food banks for collecting food for that. We've worked with first aid training. Same sort of thing. I have a limited number of volunteers who can do this. I don't want to waste their time, and I have needs. Mm-hmm. How do I map those needs out and get people connected together properly? And it's the sort of power of software. What's fun is, as a software person, when you look at the problem space, you go, that's really not that hard. Yeah. So let's go do it.
Right.
Now, the side effect as we went along for a ways is that that organizations like Microsoft basically said, look, how much Azure would you like? So where we thought we'd just write the software, now we've been operating the software on behalf of a lot of organizations because we know how. Mm-hmm. And, disaster response organizations are remarkable people. They run towards danger instead of away from it. Like, these are not normal people. They're very odd. And I'm not one of those people. I'm a technology guy. But they don't know a lot about technology. They don't know what it can do for them. And they certainly don't know how to keep it running effectively in times of crisis. And we do. Right. And so we're through Microsoft Philanthropies, which is a philanthropic organization within Microsoft. They basically feed us the Azure we need. We can turn things up and keep them running hot when running that kind of software on behalf of those organizations on demand.
I'll tell you, as we've done this podcast and my coaching background and talking with people in businesses and meeting a variety of people through this podcast, the thing that I am most attracted to, or the people, I guess, that I am most attracted to, probably not just because of the podcast, but in life in general, are the people that are super passionate about something, that then give that passion away to others. and that are in and have a service mindset, right? So people that are knowledgeable and passionate, give that gift away, and that are always kind of have the heart of a servant are, and you just seem to be kind of A plus on all those. I think that's awesome. I mean, like, you're super smart. So, you know, my brother a little bit.
Sure.
And my brother's in technology, for those that don't know that listen. And I was texting him this morning. I was like, Richard Campbell's giving his keynote right now, and he's really smart. And he was like, yes, he is really smart, was his response to me. So, but you're super passionate. You're super passionate, and all the keynotes, all the .NET rocks, you're giving that gift away. Mm-hmm. But then you're coupling that with this, like, we can do more. We can provide for people that are not doing as well as us, or that need help, that need what we're experts at. Mm-hmm. And you identified that need, right? You kind of fill the need. I think that's amazing. I guess I'm acknowledging you for that. I mean, I think that's really something.
It is easy to get lost in the weeds of a lot of this. Like I said, it's sort of that in versus on thing. Being head down is fun. Working a problem, it's really fun. Being head up is harder. Right? Is that sort of moment where you sort of look around and go, are we going in the right direction?
Right.
What does right even look like? You know, you have to have these kind of long conversations. And those leadership moments don't look like anything. Like, you can literally spend days exploring a leadership problem like that and have nothing to show for it. Where when I'm head down writing code, there's at least some code. It may not be useful, but it looks like something.
Right.
And I think people struggle with looking inactive or non-productive. Making sure you go in the right way is an incredibly important thing to do. It just doesn't look like very much. And so it's hard to make time for it, to feel good about that time for it. Mm-hmm. And I think most people don't do it enough. Right. It's not everything. You can't just keep looking at the horizon and wondering what's over there. Sometimes you got to walk towards it.
Right.
But I think we're doing too little of it most of the time.
The one, the thing I struggle with, and this, if you've listened to the podcast, I'm very transparent with this, is to be compelled to do things, to do great things, to make a contribution, and being compelled to do that in my heart and in my mind, I'm compelled every day to try to do great things. My problem lies in action, and you seem to be very actionable. Like many people probably are compelled to do a lot of the things you're doing, right? They think about those mm-hmm. things. It's on their mind. It's in their heart, or how they want to lead, or what they want to build, or how they want to contribute. The people that listen to this, if they're like me, really struggle with that action. And it's this idea, I think you said it great, it's the head down, head up, and looking around, and taking that first step. Like, do you ever struggle kind of taking these actions on things you're compelled to do, or topics to?
Without a doubt, because you also know the scope of the, you start to get a sense of the scope of the commitment, right? Like, a lot of these things don't happily go off and live happily ever after without you. They're constant care and feeding. If my sin is I'm spread too thin. Right, I only work on things I really, really care about, but it turns out I care about a lot of things.
Right,
and so if you talk to my associates, you'll find they fairly consistent. I don't get enough of Richard's time. Mm. Right, I wish we'd had more time for X or Y, and that's sort of the reality of when you're interested in as many things as I am, and you try to do as many of them as you can. I feel like often I'm delivering remarkably average results because I don't give enough attention to everything that we could get extraordinary results.
Right. So we talked offline before we got going briefly about, and I don't think we use this phrase, but it's the phrase that's on my mind right now, is how software has changed maybe over the past 10 to 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not talking technically.
No.
The role of the developer, the role of the business, the role of building and releasing great, stable, efficient software, that whole role has changed.
Yes.
And how people view software developers, and how we should view ourselves, and how we take actionable steps on things we're compelled to do, and how we can better our careers. That totally different than when you even started .NET, or when you wrote your first line of code in 77.
Sure. Well, you think about what the real side effect of the end of the dot-com boom, so that sort of 98 to 2001, was the point where we went from compute being a competitive advantage in business to becoming a business necessity. You simply cannot conduct business without having an online presence, mm-hmm. right? We came out of the dot-com boom where it's like, if you don't have a website, it's like you don't have a phone number. And you saw commercial, you saw the ascent of Amazon and this idea that more people would prefer to do purchasing without having to go to a physical store. And so how does the physical retailer and the and those kinds of organizations continue to exist? You know, today, you know, 20 years on, we now have this concept of omni-channel sales, where it doesn't matter whether I sell to you online, sell to you in the store, how you return things, how you get support for them, all channels now work. Those are technological dependencies. So the table stakes to sit down and be a seller of product require software, mm-hmm. right? The level of software that exists in an automobile at this point, the mechanical car basically doesn't exist, whether you know it or not. The reason cars now are so stunningly reliable is they're basically not maintainable by regular people anymore, right? The level of automation that's gone into the construction and maintenance of a car is so sophisticated, we benefit from that. Cars cost less, and they're more reliable. In exchange for, it takes specialists to care and feed for them. Mm. Right, that's another movement of software. So, you know, and an overarching theme in my story of what software is like in 2025 is simply it's like software is in everything. Compute is around us all of the time. It's sort of true in 2018, but over the next few years, machines are smaller, cheaper, and everywhere.
Right.
So I've got interviews in the can now with the group that is, you know, basically putting IP addresses in every appliance. That the basic piece of electronics that now lives in your appliances that makes the buttons work and the dishwasher wash dishes and so forth also can call home for maintenance information, can send you emails. Like, that's just going to be the norm. Mm-hmm. The next couple of generations of appliances, that's what you're going to see, and you're going to expect it. The regular consumer is just going to presume, I get emails from my appliances now.
Right.
You know, if you have a Nest thermostat, you've had that for a couple of years.
Yep.
Right, it lets you know how you've been consuming power. What happens when everything in your house does that?
Right.
So, you know, that's the path we're on. The software now touches all aspects of our lives.
So how, coupled with that, how has the role of the developer, their engagement, their involvement changed over those times? The sitting in a cubicle and not talking, not being involved, not having an opinion, not being a part of a team. That role's
pretty much obsolete now. The cubes are pretty hard to find, for that matter. Not for a certain number of people longing for them, but mobile development is the moment where most developers hit this moment of the machine that I write a program on is not the machine that that program runs on. Right? Because for a long, in the early stages of the personal computer movement, through the 70s, 80s, 90s, even to the early aughts, even through the dot-com boom, people weren't doing this on phones. They were doing it all on the same kind of PC that the guy who wrote it on was using. When the smartphone takes off with the iPhone in 2007, the form factor, the device, you don't write software on a phone. You use it. And so suddenly you have this schism in the mind of a developer. You are never your customer now. You work in a different space on a different machine for different kinds of people. And so you can't guess. Right? Plus, the low-hanging fruit has been plucked.
Right.
Right? The easy software is done. The software that you can just think out of your head has been built. So now you actually have to study how people work and how people play and what they're doing. It's data-driven development in that sense, that you have to gather information around the user. Mm-hmm. And the advent of the cloud has leveled this up again, where now we have such access to users that any experimental piece of code we want to actually test, I don't have to contrive a test now. I can push it out via cloud technologies into the hands of a select number of users and watch their responses. And now I'm not surveying them. I'm not asking them what they think. I watch what they do.
Right.
And that's the real measure of success with all of that software. So that's a much more engineering and science-driven way to think about software. Hypothesize, construct a test in the form of code, gather data as that code is executed in the field, analyze the results, modify your hypothesis, and try again.
What scares you about technology? So you said 2025.
Yeah.
And your keynote this morning was great. And I'm watching the devices and the head, you know, and what we're doing with contact lenses and the military. What scares you? Like, what could you see down the future? Like, hey, we need to be aware of this or have our eyes open on the direction this is heading?
I'm not as worried about technology as I am worried about people's fear around it. So allowing this anxiety that we absolutely can feel in society overwhelm us and make bad choices from that, as opposed to, you know, understanding the anxiety is there for a reason and can be addressed, that is far more concerning to me. The mob mentality frightens me. Thoughtful people can find their way forward. There is no way back, right? We only go forward on this and do better. The Luddites were an actual group of people who destroyed looms in the 1600s because weaving by hand is what they'd always done and they were afraid for their jobs. We still use looms. You don't get to go back. And so we are confronting the next wave of technical sophistication. We're starting to look at regulation around that. That's just a normal part. Social media is pervasive enough. We've hit that point like we did with the car, where we need rules. We need driver's licenses. We need street signs. We need traffic lights. We're starting to see that with social media, that there needs to be constraints around it. There needs to be a proper set of rules, whatever that happens to look like. And it's a conversation that is going on today.
Right.
So when I was playing in, the game of being in 2025, I'm like, we're on the other side of that rules and we're working on the next set of rules, right? Mm-hmm. We're very concerned about the ability of deep learning models and artificial specialized intelligences to be able to manipulate society in destructive ways. And so we're going to want regulation around that. We're going to want rules around that so that we know when someone's acting in bad faith. And I showed an example of the deep fake, which is a technology out of University of Washington in 2017, where they were basically able to create an animated face so perfectly detailed that a person looking at it wouldn't know. But there are other ASIs that can analyze that and say, this is a fake. And so we're going to be in an arms race now, again, mm-hmm. as we have so many times around technology, where we identify the bad actors. The one thing I know pretty consistently in society is that shining lights on things always has a benefit, because lies under bright light reveal themselves as lies, and truth under bright light reveals itself as truth. So the only thing you really need to be afraid of is the darkness. Shine a light and be happy to shine a light on anything that concerns you, because what it is will ultimately come out of that scrutiny.
Right.
The only folks you find that don't want to be scrutinized are probably the ones that should be scrutinized.
Right.
Most of us should be able to stand in front of the light and go, I am imperfect,
right.
but I come with a moral compass that I am doing the best I can with what I have.
Hmm. Yeah, in my heart, I feel like I'm a coach. So coaches love phrases and sayings, and that's pretty good. So I got to make sure to get that one written down. I like that one a lot. So I want to honor your time. But I do have one question. So I listen to a podcast pretty much every day.
Mm-hmm.
Gary Vaynerchuk, who's an entrepreneur guy, and if you listen to our podcast, I quote him quite a bit. He thinks the next wave of technology that people will go all in on is voice. Like, he is a proponent of that, and he
right.
is beating that drum hard, and he thinks we've just scratched the surface with it and the whole Alexa and Google. What's your opinion on that? Do you think that's the next big wave that we need to be aware of or need to wrap our minds around technically on how to use and how to use correctly? And
The problem with voice is it's too slow, right? It takes too long to issue commands. It takes too long to feed data into your head. And it's coming from a podcaster, right? But
right.
you play it 1.5 times and so forth. So looking at it unto itself, you're just going to find it'll only go so far. Certainly in the keynote, I addressed this where we're talking about the visor, because that ambient computing, the idea that I would have a listening device on my person that's listening to all conversations going on and helping to record them so that I can review them later if I need to, but also that it can sort through the most important bits for me, that's really interesting,
mm-hmm.
right? What we're headed towards with voice is this concept of agency or ambient compute, where understanding the conversations going on around us means anticipating need more effectively. We've always talked about having a piece of technology that would warn us, that would sort of be on our side all the time. And more we're seeing that what you're seeing from these pieces of latest technology are the beginnings of that sort of universal agent.
Mm-hmm.
you can remember to check weather before you go outside. But that's not agency. What automated agency is identifying that you're headed towards the door, knowing from your calendar where you're likely to be going, and automatic and having already checked the weather, and just saying to you, hey, grab an umbrella on the way out. You're going to need it.
Right.
And so you're seeing the elements of that start to come together.
You know, again, I want to honor your time. It's been an hour. So I typically have two things. One, I want to acknowledge you again for, you know, the things I said earlier. I'm really into passionate people. It's something I strive for every day, is to continue to find my passion. And we talk a lot about passion and goals and how to kind of reach those passions, but then giving it away. And I'm attracted to people that are passionate, that then offer that as a service to other people. So again, acknowledge that. I really want to also acknowledge you for the fact that we've only been doing this a short amount of time.
Mm-hmm.
So for you to make time for us, to come on our podcast, to have a conversation, really means a lot. Because I had a guy named Alan Stein on, who's becoming a big shot. You know, he's a big shot in the NBA and business development world. And he came on our podcast. I was like, man, that's a great get for us, you know. So and you're a quote unquote great get for us. So I acknowledge, because you know, we've talked to people that won't respond to emails and things of that nature. So I really appreciate that. One thing we do that I ask of all our guests, and I'm interested on your answer to this. We connected, I believe, on LinkedIn this week, mm-hmm. and I'm on LinkedIn a lot. I do like LinkedIn and all that, connecting with people. But I read everybody's bio.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess my question to you is, your LinkedIn bio, what does that say in 10 years? How will your LinkedIn bio be different than what it is now? What are your goals? Where do you want to be? How are you looking to continue to change your world?
I'm pretty much only working on things I really care about. So I don't think a lot of that's going to change. Podcasting for me is a great way to finish thinking about something and actually produce a product from that.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe if I come up with a better medium, I might change that part. I'm always involved in business, so another aspect of my bio has been this, you know, advisor, entrepreneur, and I can never imagine that stopping. Like, that's just, it is a normal, I think about the circle of people that I care most about around me. The non-trivial chunk of that is routine conversations about how we build better business, how we grow those things. So I think those aspects of me will continue. People ask me, I'm 51. People ask me when I'm going to retire, and I'm like, dude, I'm retired. Like, I only work on things I want to work on. Right. So, you know, are my desires going to change a whole bunch? That's a really interesting question. I don't necessarily know the answer to that. You know, we're going to talk about the physiological changes. For whatever reason, I cope with travel better than most people. Right? I mean, nobody loves being in an airplane, but I just adore being in front of new people, being exposed to new cultures, you know, taking in stories that, you know, you mm-hmm. don't get to tell stories if you can't collect them first. Mm-hmm. And so being in a place to collect stories is a really important part of my existence. If I start to suffer from that, I'll travel less. Mm-hmm. It's a perfectly reasonable thing. I don't know when that's going to happen. It hasn't happened in 20 years. But
is that your true life's passion? Or is there something that if you said – everything. So you said you're spread thin,
yep.
and maybe people, projects, businesses may not get the best of you because mm-hmm. you're spread so thin.
Yes.
If you were to sit back and isolate on one thing and say, I'm going all in on that, whether that be a subject matter, not necessarily just your podcast, but a subject matter that you're truly passionate about, what would you go all in on?
Yeah, that's a really tough choice. Right? Like I said, I only work on things that I really care about, but I care about a large diversity of things. Right. When I talk about those things broadly, I talk about just storytelling. Right. But helping people understand technology, not be frightened by technology, reducing anxiety around those things, those mm-hmm. are good days for me in whatever form that they take. And I talk to middle school students about that. I talk to Rotary clubs and things that tend to be older people. And those are very impassioned things you can do in a lot of different ways. So I'm great at absorbing technologies and extrapolating from them and then present them in forms that allow mm-hmm. people to feel like, this isn't a threat to my existence. This is an augmentation of my existence.
Mm-hmm.
I would continue, if I have to only do one thing, it would be focused on that. Mm-hmm. And in a lot of ways, that's all I do. It's just we put in a lot of different wrappers.
Right.
That's all.
What about professionally or personally? What haven't you done yet? At 51, many years to go. You said you have two daughters.
Yep.
Is that right? Two daughters.
In their 20s.
What haven't you done, even if it's personally? Like, what haven't you knocked out?
I mean, I have not walked a bride down the aisle.
Okay.
So, I mean, I'm imagining that'll happen one day, but not anxious to be a grandparent anytime soon. I don't have a lot to prove. I wouldn't mind visiting every country in the world.
Mm-hmm.
That's always been sort of on my radar. I tend to pick gigs based on it's a country I haven't been to yet. So I've knocked a couple of new ones this year. So I think I'm at 97 or 98.
Mm-hmm.
So getting over 100 puts you in a pretty rarefied club. But understand that's still half. You know, according to the UN, it's 202 countries.
Mm.
So I'm going to keep picking gigs based on it's a place I haven't been. I haven't spent enough time in, say, Western Africa. So working on an accelerator opportunity to build companies out that part of the world.
Wow.
And it'll just be an opportunity to visit a part of the world I haven't spent enough time in.
Mm.
So more of that.
Mm.
There's lots of pieces there. But, you know, there hasn't been a nick and cranny on the planet I haven't gone to and gone, this is really cool. So do more of that.
So how do the women of your life, how do they stack up technically? Were they raised with that technical hat on?
My wife's in the clothing industry, but the technology side of clothing, so how manufacturing is efficient and so forth, would have been an excellent programmer, and I think she'd admit that too.
Hmm.
But went a different direction. But I'm abundantly aware that my immediate family all help their friends with their computers. They don't feel like they're experts because they hang around with me and my friends and sort of see that specialization, but their actual operating skills are pretty solid. The younger daughter sort of straddled the line between medicine and technology. She's doing healthcare information systems. Yeah. But as a guy who's been an IT guy, it's like, some senior IT guy's going to encourage you to go this way and pay you a lot of money to do it because she's got a charm about her that's great. Able to do well. But they are plenty talented. I'm very proud of them.
Yeah, that's great. Well, again, thank you so much for being on. This has been a great hour for us. And how can people? I know you can go to .NETRocks.com.
.NET Rocks, Run As Radio. Twitter is usually the easiest way. Rich Campbell is my handle.
Right.
And I'm not that hard to find. I'm generally pretty Googleable.
Right. So what popped into my mind, so an hour or so ago when we started, I called you Carl.
Yep.
And I think for the past day or so, I was like, Rich Campbell. And then I equated you. So when I became a head coach at a university, I had one of the best recruits on campus that first year. And I was really lucky to get him on campus. And he was going to come in as a junior, was going to be a really good player. And I kept calling him the wrong name. His name was Vic, and I forget what I called him. And I remember walking out and it was my first time as a head coach. It was the first big-time recruit on campus. And, boy, did I think I just kept kicking myself about that. And we ended up getting him. So that was quite the sales job.
Call him Carl is not what you think. You just keep saying Richard.
Richard.
Right? I mean, I can call you Bill if you want.
Yeah, you could. Yeah, that would be
I think
fun.
We'll stick to George.
Yeah, that's fine. So, listen, I appreciate it. So everybody listening, this has been a great hour, and you can subscribe to it and share it and, you know, follow. And I'll make sure that everybody, when we post this, has all of Richard's information in the show notes. And feel free to, I guess, reach out to him. I guess I could say that. Reach out.
Absolutely.
Or listen to .NET Rocks on episode coming up on 1600 or so.
Yep. It's going to be a geek out, I think, on superconductivity.
Superconductivity.
Yeah.
Perfect. Okay.
I'm putting it down on a recording, which is dangerous because,
right.
You know, we'll see what I actually end up with a script on that one. But
right.
I think it'll be superconductors.
Perfect. Okay, with that, I appreciate everybody listening. And as we typically say with our podcast, I hope you're crushing your week. And we're going to have a number of episodes from this conference and other people that we end up connecting with. So look for those as well as we drop them. Thank you. We'll be right back.